You guys, welcome back to my Flickers of Fear movie review show. All right, so I can think of like a handful of horror movies, like recent ones that I've actually talked about, that were either set in Wales or were directed by like a Welsh director or were filmed there. Some of those would be like A Dark Song, Saint Maud, Censor, like some movies like that. As I said, I've talked about those three prior, like on this channel. But I don't think that I've ever seen a horror movie that was entirely in the Welsh language. I know that's a thing, but honestly, like, if you don't know, a long time ago, like, I used to be married to a Welsh man. And so I went back and forth to Wales, like, quite a lot, like, from about the mid-1990s to, like, the late 2000s. So I saw a lot of Welsh language content. I mean, I was in South Wales, and they speak English as well, but they do teach Welsh in schools, and they did have a channel that was, like, about half Welsh programming. But I'd never seen a horror movie that was entirely in Welsh before. So I thought that was kind of neat when I heard about this movie, which is called The Feast. Now, this came out back in 2021, and it's the debut feature from a director named Lee Haven Jones, who I believe has just worked in television prior. I think they did some Doctor Who episodes or something like that. And this kind of premiered back at South by Southwest, I think, Film Festival back in 2021. It got a little bit of positive buzz there. And I think a lot of people thought it was kind of cool because it was like novelty. And it's like, oh, this is like the first. I don't, it's probably not the first one, but it's kind of the first one to get kind of like a really wide release of like a horror film that's in Welsh. So The Feast, which in Welsh is known as Glyv, if I'm pronouncing that right, Glyv, something like that. I took a little bit of Welsh a long time ago, but my pronunciation's not that good. This is actually kind of like a really slow burn, vaguely folkloric, kind of eat the rich fantasy. And it starts out like that, but then goes like full on gross out body horror, like in the third act. Now, this movie is kind of like a strange journey. And it's definitely not for all tastes. I mean, like, nothing is, but you know what I mean? I mean, I like my slow burn horror and stuff like that, but I will say, I think the first two acts of this were slightly too ponderous and kind of like tried my patience a couple of times. But at the same time, I was almost like so interested in like what was gonna happen that I couldn't really look away from it. You know what I mean? Even though sometimes like some of the shots like lingered a little too long or something, I was just like, okay, like what's going on? Let's get on with it. But in the end, I think it was like a pretty rewarding experience. Your mileage may vary. Yeah, so it's pretty languidly paced, at least until the end. This gave me, in its themes and a little bit in its cinematography, it gave me a little bit of a vibe of Parasite, but without like any of the black humor. You know what I mean? It's kind of like thematically similar to Parasite. So here's the setup for The Feast. We have this wealthy London-based family of mostly insufferable assholes. And they're hosting this little dinner party at their really like boxy looking modern vacation home, or I guess it's like their second home in the sort of like rolling hills, this beautiful Welsh countryside. So the dad is this blowhard alky named Gwyn, and he is a corrupt member of parliament. And he's one of those real, like, kind of like macho man, like, I'm kind of know everything type of dudes. It's like one of the things that he does, like, over the course of the movie is that he has to tell everybody, like, repeatedly, oh, I shot the rabbits that we're having for dinner. Even though in reality, he didn't shoot them, he just found them dead. But it was very important to him that everybody think that he shot them, like, he was a big manly man or something like that. So there's that guy. Then you have the mom, who's named Glenda, who's very vain, very class conscious, and she ended up inheriting this farmland that the house was built on. And she got it from her parents, they got it from their parents. So it's been like in the family for generations. But she's made like boatloads of cash recently, like in the last few years, by selling off parcels of the family land to a mining company for drilling. Then you got the creeper son Gwyrdd, who is like they're both grown sons, both of them. They're not like little kids or anything. So he's like this pale weirdo who wears unitards, like shaves his balls, He's always like looking at himself in the mirror, like rubbing himself all over, like, oh my god, I'm so into myself, like that kind of thing. Like, yeah, he's super creepy. And you find out that he's either a doctor or a medical student, I can't remember which it was, but he's taken like a sabbatical from that in order to train for a triathlon. So you see him like in these ridiculous like exercise-y outfits, like, you know, on the stationary bike, and he's like eating this really weird like limited diet and all this other kind of stuff, and he's like really obnoxious about it. So there's that. Yeah, he's like a total weirdo. And then you have the other son, whose name is Guto, and he's sort of like this rebellious musician type, you know, with like all the black clothes and everything. And he was actually... he really loves London. He loves, like, the big city life, nightclubs and parties and everything like that. But he got into drugs. I guess he was, like, a heroin addict. So his family, like, made him come out here to the country, like, to recover. So both of the sons are sort of, like, a shame on their family, I guess. Just because the one is, like, dropped out of medical school or whatever so he could go be in a triathlon. And the other one's, like, a druggie. But I will say that Guto is actually the most sympathetic out of the whole unpleasant family, because he seems to be the only one with anything approaching like a sense of empathy toward others or like a conscience or anything like that. He's still kind of a douche, but not nearly as much as the other ones. And he also seems to like hate the rest of his family like as much as we the viewer are meant to. So there's that. And in his defense, if this was my family, I would totally be taking all the drugs too, so I can feel that. So anyway, into this sort of simmering familial tension, I guess, comes Caddy. And she's this mysterious young woman, and she's supposedly, like, showing up at the house in order to, she's like an assistant. She's supposed to, like, help Glenda set up the dinner party. Apparently what happened was that the girl that Glenda usually hired wasn't available for whatever reason, so Caddy was apparently, like, recommended, like, as to use as, like, a backup. Pretty much from the beginning, though, you can tell that there's something really off kilter and maybe possibly even malevolent about this young woman. Pretty much like for the first maybe half of the movie, I don't even think she speaks at all. Or if she does, like maybe it's like a word or two here or there. So she barely speaks. Her hair is like either... well, I mean, I know which it is, but it's like a spoiler alert. But her hair is just like looked like greasy or wet the whole time. She seems like she always has dirt on her hands, even though you don't really see her like putting dirt on her hands, but she always seems to get things dirty. But then like when they show her hands, there's no dirt there. So there's that. And she seems to spend a lot of the time just kind of like staring intently at members of the family. And kind of spacing out when she's supposed to be working. And also, when no one is watching her, she sort of, like, creeps through the house, like, spying on people. Like, you know, she goes in Glenda's bedroom and, like, tries on her earrings in the mirror and, like, cackles. And it's a little bit unnerving, like, to say the least. Now, there is actually one time that Caddy sort of acts normal, and that's when Glenda kind of comes into the kitchen and she overhears Caddy singing this old folk song while she's sitting there making the canapes or whatever. Now, Glenda is actually quite enchanted by this. She's like, oh my gosh, I remember that song. Like, my grandma used to sing that to me or something like that. Like, from her childhood, she remembers it. It's an old folk song. So her and Caddy, like, kind of sing together and laugh, and it's almost like a normal moment. But that is pretty much the last time that Caddy will do anything that's not remotely weird, like, for the rest of the movie. She's just a weird, weird girl. So the dinner guests start to show up. First, you have this dude named Euros, I think his name is Euros, who's, like, kind of this slick businessman type. He's also kind of, like, a total clod. He shows up super early, like, before they're even set up. He brings them, like, a wine bottle, and he, like, slips and drops it, like, and it breaks all over the driveway. And he's one of those guys, like, he'll totally, like, he'll just light up a cigarette without asking, like, should I go outside? And anytime food, like, comes by, like, within reach, he'll just, like, reach out and, like, stuff it in his face. He's not fat or anything, like, he's real skinny, but he'll eat pretty much anything that's not nailed down, apparently. Now, it turns out that this is, like, a none too subtle metaphor, I suppose, because Euros, well, I guess you could say that he's, like, a friend of the assholes that own this house, but he's more like a business associate, because what he is, he's kind of like a business broker. And what he does is he sort of like helps people that own land like make the most money out of that land. So he's been brokering this deal with this family for a long time where they're selling off the land like to get drilled, like looking for minerals and stuff like that. So the fact that he eats everything, like that he's always like stuffing his face. Like I think there's one point like when everybody's at the table and they're just like, oh, don't wait for us. And he's like, oh, okay. And starts like cramming food into his face and stuff like that. So they're trying to like show that he's sort of like the epitome of like the greedy businessman that like consumes everything in sight or like consumes everything he touches. So there's that. Like I said, it's not super subtle, but you know, it's not super in your face either. To this dinner party, there are only two other guests invited and only one of them turns up showing up. This is a kind of dowdy farm woman named Maier, and she rents the adjoining property, like, from the main family, and I think that they've lived on that land for, like, for generations. So Maier and her husband have lived on this land for a long time. I think their parents lived there and, like, rented from Glenda's parents. It was that. And that Maier and Glenda actually grew up together out here. Like, this is before, because the house they're in now, like, was just recently built, because Glenda's talking about, oh, it took so long to get it right and blah, blah, blah. Now, Maier's husband was actually supposed to come to the party as well. But Maier tells the family, she's like, oh, there was an accident, like, not too far away, in which there was, like, a car went into the lake or the river or whatever, and they had to, like, pull it out. So her husband, I can't remember what his name was. It started with an I, but I can't remember what it was. But you never see him in the thing. He's just, like, talked about. But he apparently said he would, like, loan the authorities his tractor, like, to help them get the car out of the lake or whatever. So Glenda ends up giving Maier, like, the grand tour of the house. Because, like I said, it's only recently been built, so I'm assuming that Maier has not been there. Now, Glenda is obviously very, like, pleased with herself, very impressed with her own wealth and status, it seems. But Maier, who's just kind of, like, a simple, down-to-earth farm woman, she kind of thinks the place is really cold, really, like, forbidding. And in particular, Glenda takes her to this sort of spa room that she has, like, at the end of this long hall. And she calls it, like, her retreat. They actually even show her at the beginning with, like, one of those, like, charcoal, like, masks, like, on her face, you know what I mean? And she's in there, like, zenning out or whatever. But Maier looks at it, and she's like, it kind of looks like a prison cell, which it absolutely does, because it just has these gray brick walls and shit like that. So it's pretty clear, like, through these sort of, like, awkward interactions that Maier is kind of, like, very troubled by this sort of, like, grasping harpy that her childhood friend has become, like, what wealth has done to her. So as the story goes on, we discover that pretty much the sole purpose of this dinner party was not to, like, just have friends over, neighbors, or whatever, but what they're trying to do is they have Euros there because he's trying to talk Maier and her husband into selling off their part of the land, or like not selling it, but like allowing, like signing the contract to allow the mining company to like drill there and look for minerals. The land that they farm also has this other part of it that they don't farm on that's called the Rise. And you learn like later on that there's sort of like legends in the area, like about that particular place, why they don't farm on it. Now, when Maier learns the reason for this dinner party, like why she's been asked here, she's like pretty horrified. She's like, look, this land has been in both of our families like for generations. The farm makes us, you know, sufficient money. We're not really worried about it. I think I'd rather like carry on the way I have been, like doing the farm. We're doing fine. She's like, I don't really want to kind of like rape the land in order to, like, make a few extra bucks just so I can buy, like, some shitty art like you have here in the house. She doesn't say that, but that's kind of probably what she's thinking. So while all of this tomfoolery is going on in the foreground, Kadi is lurking around in the background doing some increasingly weird shit, including, like, she takes, I believe it's, like, the dish of rabbit, like, out of the fridge or the cooler or whatever, and sort of, like, discreetly vomits into it. Now, it doesn't look like she does it on purpose, but, like, she's grossed out, and then she kind of vomits a little bit, and she's like, oh, well, I guess I'll just leave that in there kind of thing. She's maybe putting hair in their food. It's not entirely clear. Every now and then, she goes outside and, like, starts rolling around in the dirt, and, like, all the vines kind of, like, come and do, like, an Evil Dead kind of moment. Not exactly like that, but you know what I mean. Also, pretty early on in the film, remember I said like when Euros showed up and he dropped the wine bottle and it broke all over the driveway? Well, Kadi went out there and she's like, oh, interesting, this big piece of glass. And she straight up inserts that right into her little squishment in there. And so you know that that's going to be like setting up a trap for later on, you know what I mean? And indeed, that does actually come to pass. So, you know, just wait for it. So it becomes pretty obvious as, and this isn't really a spoiler, I guess, but, you know, if you'd really rather not know anything about this movie, then, you know, might want to like click off and go watch it and come back. Like I said, I feel like it's pretty obvious from very early on in the movie as it gets toward the finale, as everything gets nastier and bloodier and more maggoty, things like that, that Kati might not actually be exactly human, that she might be essentially like the embodiment of this sort of like folkloric like nature spirit that is supposed to like protect the land around here. So as I mentioned earlier, this is a pretty slow burn. So it's going to be up to you whether the kind of disgusting bloodbath at the end is worth the wait. I think to a large extent, I personally thought that it was. The characters and the family dynamic is weird enough that it really kind of keeps your attention, like for the first like two thirds of the movie, where it's kind of like languid and like sort of ponderous. And even though you kind of maybe sort of like know what Kati is up to, but she's acting like so strange and like so off-putting that also makes it like really intriguing. Like, what the fuck is this bitch up to? Like, what's she gonna do next? You know what I mean? Like, while she's like lurking around back there. So as I mentioned, the cinematography is gorgeous. There's a big contrast between the sort of, you know, the nature versus modernity type thing, because you have like these kind of bucolic, like rolling Welsh hills and everything like that, and then it's contrasted against this very modern, very ugly, squat, square house that's just kind of like sitting here in the midst of all this beauty, and it's sort of just like made of this brownish gray brick, and it's in the house has like all these big glass windows, but it's almost kind of like looking out onto nature but still like keeping it at one remove type of thing, and it just has these long dark hallways, and it's sort of like it just looks very empty and soulless, which is kind of reflecting the family that lives within it. So there's that as well. Now, I mean, the nature's revenge theme of the movie, it's not exactly subtle, but it doesn't really hit you in the face with it either. You know, I think it gets a nice balance between having, I don't know if I want to say it has like a message, but it does have, you know, that kind of theme to it where, you know, rich people that are like raping the land or taking all the resources and like nature taking revenge type thing. But I don't think it's too overt with it. It's not heavy handed, even though the metaphors and stuff like that are not really all that subtle, but it doesn't like I said, hit you in the face with obviousness. Now, the movie's not scary per se, like there's no jump scares, there's nothing like that, but it does have this weird, like disquieting type of vibe, and like it's kind of eerie, and some of the body horror stuff at the end is actually like pretty satisfyingly gross. Like I said, there's like big maggoty legs, and there's a lot of like kind of things to do with like eating you know, people's flesh, and you know, eating maggots and shit like that. So it's like that kind of shit, and it's plus like it's super bloody too. And as I mentioned earlier, it's kind of like refreshing to see a horror movie that is in a language that you don't really see. I've never seen any. I'm sure there are some, but I've never seen any horror movie that was entirely in Welsh before. So it was like kind of neat to see that, because it's a novelty. So I feel like it's almost worth watching just for that, because you just don't see that many. And particularly in the United States, you don't see a lot of Welsh language movies, period, but you particularly don't see any Welsh language horror. So I thought that was like kind of cool, especially, like I said, since I've been to Wales a lot of times. So I thought that was kind of nice to see. So if you've seen The Feast, I believe it's streaming on Amazon Prime, but I think you have to pay. If you have Hulu, it's on there for free though. That's where I watched it. So if you've seen it or if it sounds interesting to you, then let me know in the comments what your thoughts about it are, and we'll have a discussion. And that'll do it for this Flickers of Fear. I will see you guys on the next one. Bye.